Hey guys, this is April. Did you know that you can leave us a voice message with your feedback or a question right on our Anchor homepage and we can incorporate it into the podcast? So cool. Head to anchor.fm/east to west WLS. Scroll down the page a little bit until you see the message button. Using your smartphone, click that button and leave us your feedback or a question, and we will drop it in an upcoming podcast episode. We're so excited to connect with you. Thank you for your continued support of East to West WLS.
Hello and welcome to East to West WLS, the podcast where we support the bariatric community with humor, humility, and honesty. I'm April and I'm the West.
And I'm Jason and I'm the East.
Today, we are probably having the most raw and real conversation that we have ever had in our community and on our podcast. Today, if you're watching on our YouTube channel, you're going to see two very handsome looking gentlemen who are joining us today. This is my friend Ryan and his dad, Greg. Hello.
Oh, God.
Hey. He's the dad, I'm the son. Yeah. In case everybody is wondering.
Yeah. It makes sense. I mean, yeah. So good. So the reason that these two gentlemen are joining us today, Ryan and I actually went to middle school together way back in the day. We've been friends for a very long time. And after high school, we kind of lost touch. We went our separate ways. And recently, a mutual friend reconnected us over this very podcast. Ryan is like super amazing artist, guitar person, YouTuber. And I had a question about like sound engineering, which he knows way more about than I do. But during our conversation, he asked me what this podcast is all about. And I said, well, I've had weight loss surgery and Jason and I teamed up and we wanted to support this community. And he said, well, actually, you know, my mom had weight loss surgery, but it didn't end so well. And we had a really impactful conversation about your mom, Greg, your wife. And I invited you guys to come on the show to kind of talk about her experience, because while this conversation is going to be very raw, it's going to be very emotional, it is such an important conversation to have because we are going to learn about the impacts of addiction transfer and what can happen to our lives and the lives of our loved ones if we kind of don't do that work of weight loss surgery. So if hearing or listening or watching stories about alcoholism, and an untimely death, then I would recommend that maybe you skip this episode. But if you are interested in learning about these topics from the perspective of family members, then absolutely stay tuned because we are going to talk about that. So before we go any further, would you gentlemen like to introduce yourself? Just let us know like who you are as individuals.
I mean, I could introduce you and then you can introduce me. No, I'm just kidding. I'm Ryan, and we went to school a long damn time ago, and I play guitar for the internet, and before that, I worked on cars, and that's basically, that sums up my entire life. Yeah.
That was really how you and I connected. I have a 1965 Impala Supersport that I rebuilt with my father. And Ryan and I had a lot of fun kind of drooling and playing and like hanging out with that car. So that was our mutual connection back in the day.
I want an old muscle car. Forget the house.
And she, yeah, I know, right? And you still have it, do you not?
That car is never good. My grandfather bought that car for $5,000 cash in 1964. I think I'll probably be buried in it.
Wow.
I mean,
rightfully
still
so.
Still up in the air, but right? Oh, I mean.
That car.
And you remember, that car is beautiful. Oh, stunning. But
man. Yep, so that's me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Who are you?
Me, I'm Greg. I'm Ryan's dad, and it was my wife Lynn is who we're going to be immediately talking about the things that happened relating to the weight loss surgery and everything after.
Yeah.
Yep. Wonderful. Well, again, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. We know this is going to be hard and difficult, and it's going to be emotional, and that's okay. We thank you for just allowing her story to be told in this format. So like I said earlier, we do have a YouTube channel. I highly recommend that you check it out. Just go to YouTube and search East2West_WLS and you will see our amazing faces and all of our previous podcast episodes. But really, I think that's kind of it. So should we dive in? You guys ready?
Let's go.
Yep. Water's good. Let's go.
Let's nice do it.
Warm.
Hey guys, it's April. If you've been following us for a while, you know that my favorite hot beverage is Retreat Drinks Hot Cacao. I love it because it's made with four simple organic ingredients: cacao, coconut cream, maple, and Himalayan salt. That's it. It is decadent and creamy and just hits the spot when I need something sweet. And the best part about it, it's not going to break my macro bank. If you want to give it a try, visit their website, retreatdrinks.com, and use the code EASTTOWEST to get 20% off your first order.
Oh, all right, friends. So tell us about your mom. Tell us about your wife. Who was Lynn as a person?
Go ahead.
My mom really, she had always said when she grew up, she wanted to be a grandmother before she wanted to be a mom. And I think that really is, like, she wanted to really take care of kids. And like, that was kind of her, that was really her being. I don't know. She was funny, but if you angered her,
she was always looking out to be taking care and helping people and stuff, but cross her path, she was a force to be reckoned with. And it's funny, you mentioned the wanting to be a grandparent. She told me that when we were dating. Why did I still hang around?
Yeah.
We took her nephew with us on a date, this little kid, and it still didn't like click in my head yet where I was going.
Right. I want to be a grandmother. Wait, but yeah.
There's a step in there.
Yeah, there's a step in there. And I did tell you, honey, you can't be one without the other. You know, you just can't go to being a grandparent. You got to be a parent first. But I don't want to really do that.
Right. She was so sweet. She was so nice. She was beautiful. But at the same time, like if she was like, there was a store called Mervyn's back in the day. And was it her standing in line or something like that? But she they gave her the worst customer service ever. And she wrote what we would call basically a poison pen, like Lynn's poison pen. And she wrote this, like, and it was never snotty. It was a very well thought out, it was like a 4-page letter. And they subsequently used her letter as training at the corporate level for like a decade after that.
Yeah,
like
they called her and said, can we use your letter in our new trainee program, because it just
out.
And later on she got a job there.
Yeah They're like, yo, you want a job? Like that's
yeah,
that was my mom. Like, so
well, she is clearly a woman who knew what she wanted from the get-go.
Yeah, she really did. She really committed to whatever she was into. She had a job stocking magazines in, I don't know, what was that, early mid 2000s, something like that.
Yeah, magazines
that she loved. Books. Because she would go to like the, you know, Top Foods and Fred Meyer and all this stuff, and like stock magazines. And she loved like the people interaction. She really loved people. She just was always interested in people and conversations and the people experience, kind of a thing. She definitely was not, I wouldn't call her introverted at all.
No, not really. But her one complaint was she always said, I was just born with too many feelings. Because especially with family, she was always worried about, you know, what's her mom think, dad think, you know, the kids and all that. And that was kind of the downside. And another side to her was actually related to what this podcast was her weight. She was always fought her weight since she was a child. And even being an adult, she always had this little dark cloud over her head about she wasn't worthy of me or her children. Yep. It was like, well, you know, it's like we're all here and stuff, but well, I don't deserve it. You deserve a better wife or something else like that. I heard that a lot over the years, off and on.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, she really saw herself as damaged goods for my entire life, even when like she used to take us to go to exercise, and like she would just
aerobics.
She would go to aerobics at the church down at the end of 320th past Decatur High School, and like we would go with her because we were little, and she would just work her ass off, and she never thought she was good enough or worthy for the life that she had worked for. So that was always like a really, I don't know, that was the dichotomy of like her.
Well, and what you're saying rings so true for Jason and I. I think as bariatric patients, we too have felt the same way that she has felt, right? We're are always not worthy enough, and that our weight is either truly impacting us or it's not, but we think that it is.
Right.
And then the other side to that, which I think Jason can also speak to, is that, you know, we use the love that we have for other people and that caring nature to worry about everybody else before we have to worry about ourselves, right? It's like, it's an excuse. It's something for us to do because we don't want to, or we don't know how to really kind of take care of ourselves. So the fact that you so clearly articulated, you know, I think things that are seen in the bariatric community today in regards to your mom is really quite amazing, because that tells us that a lot of people in this community struggle with those exact same things. So while your mom wasn't alone, she was at the time, because there really wasn't this community that was out there to support her. There was just nothing. You were kind of on your own, I think.
Back then, there was one website, I don't even know if it's still around, but it was called obesityhelp.com. And it was around real early. And so that was somewhat of a help, but she did have a weight loss support group that she was attending for a while around here. But I think you kind of hit it just a minute ago when you said, well, she focused in on other people and making sure how well they were doing, so she didn't have to look at herself.
Right. Well, one of the things you said that really struck for me is it's very hard to be an extroverted empath, because that really kind of encompasses all of that, because not only do you love and thrive off of personal interaction, you thrive on it on a level of, it's almost like they're doing you a favor by wasting their time talking to you, like what you're talking about, like you're not worthy of that conversation. But at the same time, it fuels you to keep going, to be able to be this extrovert that you feel like. And it's one thing to have those types of feelings around your friends or loved ones, but when you have a family, when you come into having kids and a husband and those types of things, or a wife, and because a lot of our, we come to find out that a lot of the people in our community, you know, have felt that way since younger years. And then once you add on to that, you know, you're caring for other people, but you don't ever feel like you're catching up. You're running on a treadmill that's too slow, and it's just everything just keeps piling on you. On top of the fact that you can't lose the weight that burdens you down, is just such a snowballing effect that it's just extremely hard to get out from under. So a lot of us connect with that on a very real level.
Yeah, totally.
So how did your mom's weight impact her life, do you think, from, you know, from her perspective? And then can you guys talk about, you know, did her weight impact you guys as her husband and as her son? Or was it just something that she, you know, envisioned in her own life, but it wasn't actually reality?
Probably it was all the above and then some. It'd be like, we'd be standing in line at the grocery store waiting to check out groceries, and say there's a couple of gals up in front of us, and they're like laughing, and she'd just look at me, right?
They're laughing at me. About that.
I know it is. I know that. They're talking about me.
She was convinced. Yeah.
Totally,
oh my God.
100% convinced. And there's no way it was anything to do with her. From that happened a lot. And then the other parts were, to me, I always had this nagging thing at me. It's like, God, no matter what I do, she's not completely happy. Yeah. Ever. No matter what. And there was always something of a dark void there that you wasn't enough things you could say or do to fill that in or even it out, then, because that dark cloud was over there. And for a brief moment it went away when Fen-Phen came out. For her, it was an absolute miracle. She could sit around and eat cake and ice cream and fudge all day long, and the weight was just falling off her without even trying, and no problem. So that was a great, I don't know, year and a half, 2 years. And then they took it off the market and her weight just started creeping up. And so after having a taste of what the good life was for her, it was worse than it ever been.
Melted down. Do you remember when the news story broke, like the heart conditions that it was causing, and like it was causing massive heart damage. And like, she was asked if she wanted to take part in like the class action lawsuit. She was like, absolutely not. I loved, you know, worth it. And she, that was devastating for her when they took that off the market. I forgot all about that.
Yeah. And all the doctors I'd went to for years that were specialists in this, they'd said, yeah, there is something, but we don't know what it is or how to fix it in her. And yet the fenfen was it, because she would truly eat 1,000 calories a day, be doing aerobics every day, and down at the track, Dakota, running around the track, right? Just
been there, done that.
Keep it from going up. So it's like, dude, it was no matter what.
She worked real hard, and she was so it's interesting to hear about all this stuff from your perspective, because as a kid, all I knew is she was constantly talking about her younger sister, Teresa, who could literally lose weight by shoveling ice cream in her mouth growing up. Like, she was the
thin and pretty and outgoing, you know, chatty
younger sister.
Just, she was jealous of her in some ways, although they got along really good. But
they did, yeah.
She'd even made comments to me about how past boyfriends were like interested in her younger sister. And it was like,
yeah.
Who?
Well, yeah. And as somebody who sees himself as obese or who is obese, it's devastating because you don't understand why you are the way that you are. And then you turn to these really dangerous things to help you lose the weight. So you're either extremely calorie deficient, or you're going on these crazy diets, or you're taking drugs that can kill you, or you are exercising 5, 6, 7 hours a day. You're upset. You're doing all of these things to get to the place that you need to be. But now medical research has proven that your size and shape is so much more than just calories, right? There's, you know, it's more than that. But when you think that there's something wrong with you, right? Like, well, I'm doing something wrong, or I'm deficient, or it's me, then it's just all consuming. And I think that's that dark cloud that you were referring to.
I often wonder, because there was no, I think that was a huge element. At that time, back, you know, in the 80s, the government was still trying to, you know, shove carbs down everyone's throat by any means possible, and TV dinners and all that kind of stuff. Like, I often wonder if you had moved everyone's lives up even a decade, if not more, if the education had been there for food, because I myself didn't know anything about eating right until, you know, sodium, I can't eat just pizza and like pizza rolls and Campbell's soup. Like, why is that bad? Like, there was no education back in the 80s as I remember it. And I remember you guys doing the best you could, but like, you know, we ate Hamburger Helper a lot because that was way better than a TV dinner, but like, Hamburger Helper's not good. You know what I mean?
No.
But back then you just didn't know about any of this stuff.
And it was cheap though too. See,
also it was cheap, you know, working class family. However,
income, you know,
there was no education. And I often wonder if she had that education on how to actually like achieve the weight goals that she wanted to properly and in a healthy way, if that would have changed anything. But then again, I don't know if it would have.
Yeah. Her one complaint was always here, because I'm so sick and tired of doctors of saying, don't have that second piece of cake for dessert, you know? And it's like, really?
Right.
Oh, right. Jason, I can tell you how many times we've gone to the doctor and somebody has told us like, well, quick, go to the drive-thru. And you just want to throat punch people because you're like, dude, I truly do not do that. I really do eat from this healthy food category. I do all these things. I go to yoga every day. I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And I'm still this. And your answer to me is stop going through the drive-thru. I'm going to throat punch you. I mean, and I hate to say it now, and Jason can speak to this too. His wife is actually, she just had surgery a few days ago, but the nutritional education is lacking still, which is part of the reason that East to West exists, because we understand really where it's missing. Whereas your mom, your wife got nothing. We got a binder that said, eat this, not why or how or what it does in your body. None of that. Just eat this for week 1, 2, 3, 4 months. And then after 6 months, good luck. You're on your own. You have a tiny tummy. Bye.
Whoa. Yeah, the Weight Watchers diet back
in
the
day. It's not even that. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, when Lynn did have her surgery in 2001, I got to say, we got really good information and education from the doctor who did it. His name was Dr. Kai Oh. He was the 23rd doctor in the United States that was allowed to teach the procedure.
Wow.
And so it was like all liquid diet for the first month. And then after that, semi-liquid with a couple of crackers and all that. And she would get on that website Obesity Help, and people are saying, I just had surgery and I can't understand why. I just try to eat a piece of chicken breast and it just comes up. And it's like, you're what? I mean,
yeah,
literally back then people didn't know. And it was like, you do your protein.
Yeah.
And yep, different kinds work better for some people than others. And also with her surgery, she lost about 90% of her excess weight.
Wow.
But at the same time, I think I was a contributing factor to her early demise, because they bypassed so much. She got not the shortest, not the longest, but what the middle one was. And she had the full RNY, and they left 68 inches of her colon left in her body when they did the bypass.
Oh.
And in the early 90s, they were going as short as 45 inches. I worked with a guy who had it done that short. And he was like one of the first ones that get covered by King County Insurance. And he was almost 400 pounds before, but they quit doing them that extreme. And even how extreme Lynn had it, because people just don't keep up on the supplements, particularly protein. Ryan harped on her, and I harped on her constantly about it, but my blood test, it shows up okay. And I'm like, huh, no, it's taking it from your body to keep that up. But eventually you get tapped out. And
I think
that's what it was of her. That was a contributing factor that just kind of made her weaker in general, especially like your heart muscle. I mean,
I mean, her body was essentially eating itself just to stay up, because she wasn't doing, because it could, it's tough to keep up with all that.
Over a period of, 20 years, that's kind of what happened. Mm-hmm. And then you throw in the drinking thing for about 10 years, hardcore, and she wouldn't eat at all. She just sat and drank all day long. And
oh my God.
And of course, with that kind of a bypass, there's no way your body regulates what goes in it, so it's just like your pouch is the size of a couple of shot glasses, and so you got big glasses. Guess what? But alcohol and needle stick in your arm, it was the same effect.
Jason's actually never drank in his life, so he's not familiar with what that feeling is. I can speak to it. I'm almost 2 years out, and I can have a Truly, and I am intoxicated, right? Or yes, you have half of a drink and you are intoxicated. So it is a very different feeling after surgery than it is before surgery. And the danger with that is that, I mean, because you can consume so little, but you are intoxicated at such a quicker rate, you instantly realize, oh my God, if I'm really struggling, I can just go have a half of a something. And I'm like, I'm well on my way to not feeling those feelings. And if you are not recognizing that you are turning that addiction, or you're not transferring that addiction from food to these other things, and you're not addressing it, it's going to lead to some very horrible outcomes, as you have both experienced.
Especially in the beginning, your body is so sensitive. I mean, we went to somebody's wedding, and just not thinking about it, had this glass of punch, and it was like, I don't feel so good, because all that sugar goes straight into you and your system doesn't know how to deal with it, and get the overload and the dumping thing. And I got to go home and lay down, and I get her home and almost carry on. It was almost like being drunk in a way, except it was like sugar levels were just so crazy high. Yeah. And she'd lay down and sleep for a couple of hours and then wake up feeling like she had a hangover. She really in her adult life didn't drink.
She was allergic to alcohol.
She turned red in the face, and with her weight as it was, she didn't touch it anyway. The only time she really drank was probably high school or shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
But that'd been it forever.
Yeah, my entire life, we'd never, ever seen mom with even so much as a wine cooler. Nothing. No. Nothing.
Not oh, my God. Thing. So to go from that reality before surgery to her having this procedure, and then what was the timeline? So I do want to ask this question. Do you guys happen to know what her high weight was when she went into surgery, or do you have a rough estimate?
5'1" and 240 pounds. She was, for insurance to cover, she had to be at least 100 pounds overweight, with several other problems, which she was having real knee problems, blood pressure, cholesterol, all that jazz, right? Just go down the standard list of your top five. And those were all things. And for me, that was the reason that she had the surgery, because I was initially dead set against it, because I thought it was all for vanity. And there was like no way I was going to let it happen.
There was that element.
There was, but that wasn't the prime.
No, reason, it wasn't.
So I compromised. You know?
Yeah.
Can you guys talk to that? So like, who is she? So, I mean, really, as we understand it, she lost a bunch of weight on a really scary system, saw what it would be like to live at a lower weight, was devastated when that went away, wanted to try to find a way to live at a lower weight. So there was this medical stuff, but then there was the vanity side of things. What was that all about?
I suspect that she probably sold you differently than she sold me. I was against it as well, because the first I ever heard about it was, I'm going to be skinny again. And at this, so, okay, to line up a timeline, I was about to have my first daughter, my only daughter. I don't have many daughters. Okay. I have one daughter. My girlfriend was like 8.5, 9, like just, we were literally, I think as she was born and she had the surgery, what, just a couple of days?
Right afterwards.
Literally like 4 days later, she had the surgery.
Because she wanted to see and meet her granddaughter in case she died during surgery.
Yeah.
Is that serious?
Yeah, yeah. So she sold it to me. The first she ever mentioned it to me was, I'm going to be skinny again. And I was like, what? You're going to have, what the fuck? And she was like, don't you want me to be happy? That's what she told me.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
I kind of remember that actually.
So, yeah. And I was like, well, I mean, yeah, but God damn, that's a little extreme, isn't it? And then the health stuff. Oh, okay. Yeah. But I'm like, I don't know about that. Like, that seems pretty extreme, Mom. But I was dealing with, you know, my new kid and stuff like that. So,
yeah.
But her brother, who had a pretty strong influence in her life for a long time, too, was like, he was dead set against it. And her mother wasn't exactly happy about it. I don't think either one of my parents or her parents were that thrilled, but it was like, there was enough medical things, especially when you're, I don't know, 45 or something, and things are getting a lot worse, a lot faster. And looking down the road, it's like, well, where's your blood pressure going to be? You're going to, like, you're going to have a heart attack and then die another 10 years if you don't have it.
Yeah.
And we did go to a lot of support group meetings, particularly one that where the patients were all from Dr. O, and it was like, oh, okay. I was good with it at that point.
Well, and I guess that's kind of my next question. I mean, Jason can absolutely speak to this. When you see before pictures, Jason's before and after pictures, Jason was on death's doorstep. I mean, I'm going to let you speak to that. But when you see it that way, it's like, okay, this has to get done. But
sure.
After Jason tells his story, I have a follow-up question for you guys about why you were so against it. Jason, do you want to explain kind of your experience with this?
Yeah, I didn't get heavy until I was 28. I mean, as a child, I was chubby, of course, you know, you'd grow the out and then grow up and then grow out. But as I got older, I'm 6'4", so I stayed around 225, 230 pretty much forever. And then I had health issues just kick off one day, and I gained 100 pounds in like 7 months. And then I gained another 90 pounds, and then it was just snowballed from there. And I had been approached about weight loss surgery from different specialists, but none of them that I actually had a connection with. And so when they brought it up to me, it's like, you don't even know me. And you're asking me if I want to do this, you know, like, you don't know that I could do it on my own. Like, don't come at me with this. Do you want to have surgery for weight loss? Because you don't know all the work that I'm putting in. Like, I'm going to do it on my own. I don't need you. So I had just kind of blown it off for years and years. Well, cut to the fact that I'm, you know, 40, I was 44 at the time I had it, but I literally was to the point that I had missed out on a good chunk of my son's, you know, formidable teenage years of being able to do stuff with him, and kind of when I should have been showing him a lot of the stuff that fathers show their sons during that time frame, I would just miss out on it because I couldn't stand up long enough to do any of that stuff, or I couldn't move around good enough to do those things. Wow. So when I event, you know, because I was the one that was dead set against it for myself without anybody else even having to say anything to me. And so eventually when I spoke to a doctor that I actually had a good connection with, because I brought it up to her like it was going to be like she was going to laugh it off with me and be like, well, that guy just doesn't know you. And she looked at me and straight was like, I mean, it's not an awful idea. And I'm like, what do you mean it's not an awful idea? And she's like, I mean, for real. Because at this point, my nose had swollen up and was just purple to the point that the oxygenated blood was not getting to the parts of my body. And my doctor flat out was like, your nose is dying on your face. Your legs, like my legs had swollen up to the point and my skin was so thin that they were just busting open like hot dogs that had been left on the grill too long. Because what she had said was, I have so much fat in my legs that it's constricting the blood flow. So essentially the skin on my legs was dying, just like my nose on my face was dying. You couldn't find a vein in me to save your life. Like everything was just encased in so much fat. Because I weighed 468 pounds, and at my heaviest, I think, and that was before I started the liquid diet to actually have the surgery. When I was at my actual heaviest, I think I was more closer to about 480 pounds. But just everything about my mobility, my health, my everything, I mean, I was on a blood pressure medicine regimen. A doctor told me he's never seen anybody within 25 years of my age be on this type of blood pressure regimen. He said, this is for people 80 years and up, man. I don't know what you're doing. He's like, and your blood pressure's still high on 4 oral blood pressure meds and a patch that I wear that's extended release all day long. He's like, you're not just in a health crisis. He's like, you're not going to make it. Like, this is how serious this shit is. And it took that kind of like kick to get me to finally go, oh, I guess you guys really know what you're talking about. Maybe I'll look into this.
Yeah.
That's like,
I think it's
chill a normal person, really.
Yeah. Right. And this is the, you know, these are the conversations that we have to have with ourselves and with our loved ones, because it is scary to undergo bariatric surgery. Is scary. It is kind of a great unknown, especially because we've never lived at a low weight or at a healthy weight. So we don't even know how to get there. And then there's the complications during surgery, complications after, there's all this stuff. But then when you know that you've got this medical thing going on, but you know, you also want to look a certain way, you really have this drive to do what you need to do, you know, taking this leap of faith. So, you know, knowing that there's reasons for doing that, why were you guys opposed to it at the beginning? Was it just something that was brand new at the time and it was just very scary? Or were there other things that were going on that prevented you from, you know, being for her surgery?
For me, it was, well, at that time, you know, 2001, it was pretty new. Like if you, I mean, not even Googled it, Alta Vista'd it at the time, like there was, you know, pre-Google.
No, nothing.
No, there wasn't hardly anything. Also, no. For me, I wondered, and I asked her, I'm like, you know, all of these feelings and things that you feel aren't going to suddenly go away just because you like lose a bunch of weight. Like your childhood doesn't go away. And she was like, no, but I would feel better about, you know, the great justifier. She would always justify it and just sell it. And I was just like, well, you know, I'm gonna go be a dad and do this thing. So like, let me know if you need anything.
Yeah.
And that was pretty much it.
I think for me, it was still unknown, but I went to a lot of the meetings, you know, there was even a few where, you know, talking with the doctor and the people there that were running the meetings had gastric bypass, like, you know, 94, 95. And theirs was a very more extreme than Lynn's was. And I got okay with that. But I think Ryan hit on a good point that Lynn, I think, like, probably almost everybody's like, oh, if I was just thin, life would be perfect. Everything would be great and wonderful. It'll all fall into place if I was just normal. I was normal. Well, even after the surgery, no, you're not normal. And has a surgery, then all of a sudden, she started coming home, and after she'd lost most of her weight, she'd just be furious and mad. I go, what happened? This guy held a door open for me. I go, what? that Saint bastard, if I was fat, he would have slammed that door in my face. But because I'm thin now, he holds the door and says, hey, how you doing? You know, and that just infuriated her. And I go, you can't do anything about how people react to you. You just can only work with how you react to them. You can't change people like that. It really upset her for a while.
Mm-hmm. But it's so interesting that she verbalized that with you guys, because again, something that many of us after bariatric surgery go through is you really have to face the reality of how the world works. And that is that if you are deemed more visibly attractable, right? Or if you look a certain way, if you fit into these society, you know, standards for a good looking person, you are going to be treated differently. And you don't want to believe that, but then you have the surgery and you lose weight and you go, oh my God, that is exactly what is happening here. And it is infuriating, because all of a sudden in that moment, you realize that you have been discounted by society for your entire life, or for that entire point of your life that you thought you were fat. You really get bitch slapped with how the world works. And it is devastating, devastating. Yeah,
because you've been treated as like, you know, well, you're fat. That means you're dumb and don't have any feelings, right?
Right. Bingo. And that's not the case. It's not the case at all, right? Your size and shape has nothing to do with your intelligence, your personality, what you have to offer to them, nothing. But because you believed it, and because it is true, you have made these decisions in your life that were impacted by your weight, and you are just so furious at that. You're furious at yourself and others. Yeah, Jason.
Well, and it takes such a small sample size for you to make your mind up that's how the whole world viewed you. Like, it only takes, like what you said, that one instance or a very small sample size of those instances for that to click in your mind and just be like, well, that means every single scenario that I ever thought was the case, that was exactly the case. That's what it was. There's no way to get around it. And that's really tough to deal with. But also, speaking to the vanity point that you were talking about, I remember my only vanity point that thinking about the surgery when I finally agreed to it was, I just don't want to be, my normality version was, I don't want to be stared at anymore.
Right.
Because like I said, I at 6'4", 468 pounds, not easy to miss. Like, you know, I'm in the room. And so anytime I'm anywhere, like, I felt like like you said, your mom would always think people were staring and giggling and laughing and snickering. I just knew that people were aware that I was there, because I'm just big and just, I stick out. And so I always felt like I was in the way. I always wanted to find the closest corner that I could stuff myself in so people wouldn't have to try to wedge themselves around me. So I was ready for all of that to go away. And that was the biggest vanity point that I can remember speaking to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and even after you get to your low weight, you still feel that you are taking up that same size. So there's all kinds of things that bombard you as you are losing this weight. So it's this combination of this euphoric life and then this devastating truth that kind of mashed together, which you guys lived through. I mean, because you described her before surgery, right? And then after surgery, she kind of became this very different person. Or it sounds like maybe more of her came out, but it wasn't necessarily good.
Right, yeah. Right. And the thing is, she would still, for a long time, look at herself and perceive herself as still being the old way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took several years. I'm not even sure at what point it kind of started to go away, but it finally did. But even with the reality of, she, you know, saved one pair of her biggest pants she'd ever worn and stepped into them and held them out and stuff like that, but it didn't register. Still, it took a long time for it to click to where this is your new normal. It's okay. And it got, finally, at one point, it was like, she drew the line. It was her sister, of all people. Oh, this is my sister, Lynn. Doesn't she look great? She had a gastric bypass. And she was like, I don't want to be known as gastric bypass Lynn anymore. I just want to be Lynn, period. And like, kind of dropped the whole moniker. And that was a good thing. But the bad thing was, she didn't keep up going to the weight loss support group meetings and things. And that's when she, I think, started to like not do the supplements quite as religiously as she needed to and stuff like that. So that was a double-edged sword for sure.
I remember one thing when you said that made me think about that, because to us and to people that know our journeys and what we've been through, we look great compared to what we looked like before. But I remember I said something to my wife about it. I was like, you know, it's funny to me because we're out and I feel better. Like, I know that I'm losing weight. I've lost a ton of weight. Like, I know that. But to people that don't know any better, I'm still fat. Like, I'm still a big person that's just out moving around. They just don't know how big I used to be. But by society standards, I'm still too big. And I told her, I was like, it really messes with my head because to me, I've done fantastic and I think I'm doing great. But to other people, I'm still just the same fat ass dude that's walking around that probably shouldn't be where I am, you know, wherever it is I am. So it's a mental game that's really tough to get through.
Yeah. And I think that's something that probably doesn't get discussed enough ahead of time before somebody has surgeries, like all the mental things, the situations and the interactions with people and stuff, because there's people we've known through the doctor's office. They were young and just married, passionately in love, and they both were big people. They both had gastric bypass. All of a sudden, you've got infidelity, and then next thing you know, they're getting divorced and everything. And this one particular couple I'm thinking of, they were like just puppy love even after 5-6 years, and then gastric bypass surgery, it all fell apart.
Yeah, totally.
Well, the two most interesting stats for bariatric patients, well, I don't know if interesting is the right word, but they say that you have a 50% chance of a relationship or a marriage ending after any type of bariatric surgery. And you have an 8-fold chance of becoming addicted or dependent to drugs or alcohol after surgery. So eight times more than just like the normal human number. So the fact that you combine those two things, which are devastating to personal, you know, to a person and to families and relationships, you now have just amplified those things after bariatric surgery. So if you are not taking the steps and doing kind of that mental work, if you are not following doctor's orders, if you are not staying on top of your nutrition, it's very easy to see how somebody could all of a sudden rely on something else to get through because you have just not been prepared for what life is actually like after surgery.
Really interesting statistics. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 20 years ago, there wasn't any. I mean, it was kind of known, well, you could have relationship problems, but the addiction, and especially the alcohol, even as good as our doctor was, it was like, just don't drink. Well, why? It just don't drink.
Yeah. Just don't.
You know, no. That was it. And then,
right, because doctors don't tell you you're going to try to transfer your dependence on food, right? Like we all get that side because we're using, right? Exactly. Right? We're using food in a way that's not healthy. So our brains are wired to get us out of pain and discomfort as quickly as possible. Well, I can't go to food anymore because I'm going to dump or I'm going to vomit. So what can I do? What's in my house? Food.
And that's the thing. Like they talk about it. The most you'll get out of a doctor about not drinking is, if you drink beer, it's carbonated. If you it's empty calories. If you drink this, it's the, like, they always have these reasons as to why, but the main reason that comes out is never that it's you're more likely to be addicted after that. And throw in the fact that you're like, you start out of the gate, if you're a child of alcoholic parents or alcoholism runs in your family or addiction runs in your family, you're already 8 times more likely to become addicted to a substance once you start using a substance. So you take that on top of what you are post-op, that's 16 times more likely to do that. So, I mean, you're kind of stuck from the get-go if that's the case. And I myself being a child of an alcoholic father, and I mean, I've got addiction all the way through my bloodline. So my father really instilled in me from a very, very young age that I didn't have to drink, I didn't have to smoke, I didn't have to do all the things that other people did to be able to have a good time. And he really drilled that into me all of my life as I was growing up, from as young as I could understand it until I remember him still talking about it to me when I was in my 20s. And it still hadn't touched it. But I mean, that was one of the biggest things that spoke to me, was knowing, even though I never physically have seen my father intoxicated ever, like he drank to a level that he just always looked fine, even though he probably wasn't. But there was never like a telltale sign that he had been drinking. He was just, you know, he was that level.
Yeah.
But I just always knew that I didn't want any part of that for me. So I really hung on, like if I hung on to anything he told me growing up, that was one thing I did. And I just happened to be lucky enough to stay with it until now. I'm, you know, 45 years old and just still have never done
it. Well, don't bother starting.
Cause, right.
Yeah. Because like for Lynn, there was a definite family history of the addiction, not necessarily with her parents, although her parents almost every day would have one or two little glasses of wine every day on a regular basis. But it wasn't anything, but her brothers had issues, her nephew had issues, her grandfather was a definite alcoholic for sure. But yeah. You know, back in those days it was like, well, boys will be boys and men will be men, you know, especially him being a retired truck driver. It's like, well, what? That's what they all do.
Yep. Yeah.
Hey, it's April with East to West WLS. I don't know about you, but after I dropped a significant amount of weight, my body just didn't feel like my own, and I needed help feeling like it was my own again. So I started receiving chiropractic care. If you live in the Tacoma area, I cannot recommend Grit City Chiro more. Dr. McKenzie is passionate about helping you feel, function, and live better. Check out her Instagram at Grit City Chiro or her website, gritcitychiropractic.com, for more info and to book your first consultation. And if you mention East to West, you'll get a discount on your first visit. I feel amazing after seeing her, and I think you will too.
So can you guys tell us what was life like for her and for you guys after surgery? Kind of what was this progression, and when did you notice that things were not probably going as well as what they should have been?
We were just talking about this.
For the first 3 years or so, it was great. She was finally happy for a change. And, you know, the drinking part kind of started when we were on like our second Caribbean cruise, and she just wanted to like fit in with everybody else. And yeah, she got a little tipsy, and the one couple we ended up getting to know pretty well, she was an alcoholic for sure. It once we got off the cruise ship, it never stopped. But even at that point, Ryan had come to me and said, is mom okay? What do you mean? Well, she's like not just drinking, but like drinking a lot. And it's like, yeah, she is. And I noticed it too, but I think it's just kind of like when you turn 21, you know, it'll just kind of run its course and settle back down and not be a big deal. And it made sense to both of us, but that wasn't the case. It just kept going and kept going. And the thing is, when somebody develops that kind of problem, it gets really bad before you finally see and understand what's going on, because you spent your whole life trusting, believing, giving this person the benefit of the doubt. And seriously, all the red flags were all over the place. And I know for me, I didn't see a single one of them till in the thick of it. It was like, oh man, now this is a problem. And then it kind of started off as, well, just don't let me have more than, you know, blah, blah, you know, drink or whatever, like trying to use me and blame me for it.
She did that a lot. Putting the response, well, your dad let me have more than I should have.
Yeah.
But even in the, even
I was
in the
one responsible for the amount she drank.
Right. In the very beginning, I'd moved out by that time, you know, I was 21, and someone had gifted me a bottle of Jack or something. I can't remember why. I don't normally go and buy bottles from Jack Daniels, but I think it was for a birthday party and people were here. Anyway, I put it in their freezer, sealed, never opened. And I came back the next day and it was gone. And, and I didn't know she had started drinking like that. And I was like, I thought she poured it out. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. Did you not want, like, I didn't, you should have told me if you didn't want any, you know, alcohol in your house or something. I'm sorry. And she drank it. And I was like, what do you mean you drank it? Like, she told me, she was like, well, I'm sorry. I drank it. I was like, some of it, like, would you pour it out or did you spill it or something? You drank this bottle. She was like, sorry about that. And I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah, I mean, she went from like almost literally no alcohol in the house. I mean,
to balls.
I had it, but I had it out in the freezer in the garage, because when I'm out in the garage dinking around and stuff, I'd have a beer or a few drinks or something, and
yeah,
just kept it out there. And then all of a sudden he comes home and it's like, it's gone. And she said she drank it, and wow. And that was the other thing why we didn't see a lot of this, that in the beginning, she was very, very good at hiding it. Very good.
The best. The best. The best.
This house is only 800 square feet. And to this day, I have no idea where she would hide multiple half gallon bottles of pink Chablis that she'd get at 7-Eleven. I have no idea where she put them.
Or eventually she moved to Canadian Club, because I think someone told her that it was sugar free or something like that. So she used to just buy just tons of Canadian Club and hide them.
Wow. Well, I mean, that is a telltale sign of a vice that has gone to excess, right? That has transferred to another full-fledged addiction. Passing responsibility to somebody else for your actions, another key indicator, right? Like all of these things that you're describing are just, this is the pathway to addiction.
Exactly.
And what makes it very difficult, I think, especially for bariatric people, is you want so desperately to feel normal, and then you lose a bunch of weight and you kind of look and feel normal. Except you don't actually feel normal. There are still things like what you guys said, right? And you even called out before surgery. Like, I don't think this is going to make you feel better. It's not going to fix these things that are going on. You're just kind of like, you know, masking it. So then when you get to this low weight and you kind of sit back and you look at what's going on and you think about your life, you go, oh my God, that really didn't fix a damn thing. Like, I look better now and I'm healthier, but I guess that wasn't what I was really after. And now you're just devastated all over again, right? Because, well, that didn't work. So now I really am a total and complete failure. You feel so awful, and you are hardwired to get yourself out of pain and discomfort in the quickest way possible.
Yeah,
and for many people, it's alcohol. Even as you said, like she was allergic to it before surgery. So then why after surgery, why do you think she went to alcohol and maybe not something else? Why was that her go-to?
I specifically remember her being on the phone when I came up. So she used to watch my daughter. She used to save us unbelievable amounts of money by watching her granddaughter during the day while me and her mom worked. And it was awesome. And I would just stop by and pick her up, and her mom would drop her off in the mornings. And I remember her being on the phone, and she was just recovering. And I remember I don't know who she was talking to, but they were like, we can drink and we can get drunk really fast. And she was basically like, really? And like, I remember her being like, I think I can drink. I'm gonna try it. I was like,
right. And as you know, you have a couple of sips, you don't go through that little warm fuzzy period in between. It's 0 to 1,000 miles an hour in an instant.
And then she would hide it, but like, you would never know she had drank, but then she would be saying really just vile things. And I'm just like, who are you? Like, what is happening?
Yeah.
Are you
okay?
She could not have been more opposite of who she was.
No.
I called her anti-Lynn is what it turned her into. She just stuff. Like, I mean,
she would say,
I can't think of any really. But.
She would say the most, just the most horrible thing you can say to a husband. And then in front of me, she would take off her wedding ring and throw it at him while he's cooking her dinner. And I would be like, what is happening right now? Like, mom, what the hell? Like,
No, they are completely different people. And like that.
And then the no recollection of any of it. So then.
Yeah.
Trying to have a couple. Well, I don't remember that. I don't remember. I don't remember doing that. So
there was times.
Yep. So it never happened.
Yeah. Never happened.
There was times I'd come home from work and she's in the bedroom arguing. Who's in the bedroom arguing with her, for one? So I kind of go down the room, slowly open the door. There's a drink on the nightstand. She's in bed all by herself, having a full blown argument, like somebody's in there screaming and yelling at the whole nine yards. I'm like, wow. A couple of times. I mean, she'd even called the police once on me over something.
Yep.
And three cops show up. And they go, well, you just shouldn't let her drink like that, or and blah, blah, blah. And they're like, oh, gee, thank you. What a great idea, you bunch of dumbasses. And I go, here, listen to me very carefully. You see how she is right now, how belligerent she is and stuff. And she comes to you and says this, either you go buy it for me or I'm going to get in the car and go get it myself. What would you do? Nothing. Those guys didn't have one answer. And I knew they couldn't answer that question.
Yeah, it's very much a rock and a hard place. And if you're not in the mental space to listen to your loved ones, this is kind of what happens. I remember maybe 3 months after surgery, we had just moved into this new home. I was stressed, but you know, all of these things that we were talking about was going on. And I bought myself beer at the grocery store, and I don't like beer. It's not like I would never in a million years order a beer. And I came home with beer, and I was sitting on the couch and I was drinking my beer. It was not comfortable. It was carbonated. I was so soon out of surgery. And my very loving husband, without any malice or, I mean, it was just literally an observation. He asked me like, oh, what are you drinking? And I was like, oh, it's the new brew from Silver City. And he just went, huh, you don't like beer. And I was like, what that, you mean, you know, then I just turned into this like awful human because I'm like, you calling me out like this is cool, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then he was like, I just said you don't like beer. Remember he asked me, he was like, do you like beer now? You know, and I was just like, I'm going to murder, like, this is the night that you're dying, dude. Like, you are over it. But thank God that rational part of my brain that I got back in surgery kind of went, you should probably listen to what he's saying because he's noticing something. He isn't judging you. He isn't saying, don't do that. He's just literally saying, that's odd. You don't like beer. No crap, I don't like beer. But I was so desperate to get out of these emotions and to not be thinking about what I was going through that I was legit going to murder my husband. But if I didn't listen to that, who knows where I would be now? Like, truly, who knows? Because it's a real short trip from I don't have a problem to I'm killing myself with alcohol. It is a very short trip.
Yeah. See, there was a lot of those blow ups like that, but there was no epiphanies or anything. It went from her hiding it to sort of just showing it around me. And then it got to the point where all of a sudden now I'm having to make excuses up for her. Why she's not here or there, or why she's not to work, call her boss. She can't make it in today. And that went on for a while until the way it came to a kind of a grinding halt. And I told her, I can't keep living like this anymore. A couple of mornings in a row going to work. And then within a day or two, she got a DUI.
Oh yeah, should I tell him about that?
Since you were actually here. But it started was she was went to 7-Eleven to buy more beer that she didn't like. She used to squawk at me when I drank it, like Old English 800 and stuff. She went there to go get the beer. She had her car keys but nothing else, no purse or wallet, money, etc. So they let her beer sit there on the counter while she gets in the car, goes back home, gets her purse and comes back. And when she's pulling into the spot, the front rubbery bumper on the Camry bounces off the front tire of some guy who thought a whole lot about his pickup truck, and he called the police.
So drunk
until the police show up, and then he realizes that, oh, she's drunk. He slips away. They never did get his name or nothing.
Oh my god, he
left. Of course, 7-Eleven guys say, oh, we weren't going to sell her that or anything. Bullshit. It was right there on a counter still the second time.
Yeah.
So I'm at Boeing at this time and I'm working second shift. So I start at 3 and I get a call like at 5 o'clock or something like that from the Frederick Way police telling me to come pick up my mom. And I was like, what? What happened? Is she okay? I'm like, we arrested her for driving under the influence. I was like, oh, let her sit. I don't want to fucking get her. Just let her sit. Well, if you don't come get her now that we've got a hold of you, if you don't come get her, we're going to come and arrest you and throw you in with her because we don't have the room. Yeah.
They don't have any overnight.
Federal Way doesn't have an overnight hold tank.
So what the hell?
I'm pretty sure they do now.
So now there's two of you that they can't hold. What the hell good is that?
I don't know, but she was like, unfortunately, I'm gonna have to come pick you up if you don't come get her. And I was like, the fuck? Okay.
my God.
So I have to leave work. I go and get her, and you're still at work.
I'm still at
work. You were doing something. Okay, well, to be fair, you were at the end of your fucking rope.
Yep.
For one, you were over it, but you were doing something really important. I don't remember what it was, but you were in a meeting for like 2 damn hours or something. I could not get a hold of you.
No, some of the stuff I was doing the last several years before I retired had to do with supporting different government projects and things at Boeing and security clearances. And so, no, you don't have cell phones and stuff like that. And
yeah,
there's hours and hours and hours where I may not be reachable. So I finally get out of there and I pick my phone up, check messages, and it was like, what? But there was something also in the mix too, where I couldn't go get her and she couldn't come back home because I was part of the problem or something.
Well, also that she didn't want to come back here because she was fed up with, she was fed up with you or something like that. Again, she was by the time, so to put it in perspective, how intoxicated she was, she had already been there like 4 or 5 hours by the time they called me, because they wanted her to sober up. And they were also observing her medically to make sure she was all right. Mm-hmm. By the time I get there, yeah, I think she was arrested at noon or something, or 11 a.m. I get there at like, it's like 5 p.m. or something like that. She could barely walk still. Yeah. She was she was out.
When they picked her up at noon, she blew a .23.
Oh my God. That's almost legally dead.
And I was like, wow.
She drove
all the time. All the time.
I was fearful many days going to work, going, what is she going to do? And I gave serious thought to calling the Auburn or the Federal Way police and say, do sell booze. Go sit on this street corner and look for a Camry. Yeah. Here's this license plate number, and pull her over. And I still kind of regret not doing that before, but this came about at the same time when I said, I can't keep living like this anymore.
Yeah. So, So I pick her up. She goes, I'm sorry. And I took her back to my house. She stayed the night at my place. And then I think, I don't even remember. Like, there was so much going on, but like, you were going to change the locks or something, or like, you were over it. So like,
I was so mad about it.
You were pissed because also you have security clearances.
Could impact my job and
your livelihood.
They were, they were aware of when she called the police and they came out with the three cops. That was duly noted, but wasn't an issue, but they still knew about it.
So, so we basically, I go and get, you know, I get her a lawyer, I go and go to take her to her hearing the very next day and all this stuff. You're not even hearing any of it. You're just like, I'm done. Cause this was basically the straw that broke the camel's back. And I don't even know if I'll ever know most of the stuff that you bore the brunt of here. Cause you know, I'm married by this time. Yeah. So this was 2010?
Yeah, I think so.
What, 2010-ish? I bought a house out in like South Hill and I'm married and I'm like going, you know, like I'm
You're doing your life.
Yeah, I'm doing my life, right? It's like I'm long gone and you're done. And
did she go end up over at her mom and dad's after that?
And then she went and stayed. Yeah. So we came here while you were at work. And she packed up a suitcase and I took her over to her mom's house, her mom and dad's house. And she stayed there. I don't know how long.
It was several days. And in my mind, I was like, that's it. I'm done.
You were
done.
You were done. And I don't even know how she's sober. Dude, it literally took her like 2 days to sober up.
I'm not
even exaggerating.
Yeah. Let me throw in something else you probably don't know about. While she was staying at her mom and dad's, little travel size of alcohol bottles they've picked up somewhere 20 years ago that are in the back of some cabinet. She found those and drank them all, and her mom felt horrible. That's why she was there an extra couple of days. I didn't know about this till years later. Whatever little bit of hooch they saved that was 20 years old or something, she found it and drank it. And they told me they were so sorry. They didn't even think about it.
I didn't know that.
Because it was always there. It's like,
yeah, hey, but that's addiction. Don't
drink, but
yeah.
Searching through the house, knowing where something was when she was a teenager, and well, it was still sitting there. But
yep,
I was so mad and fed up, but it was like her mom brought her home.
Yep.
I still loved her.
Yeah.
It was like, I went literally under my breath. I went, shit. I still love her. I opened the door. She looked so battered and beat up.
She looked terrible.
It was awful. And they're like, come here. I just went from there. She went to court.
Oh.
Yep.
Court said, 0.23, only a conditioned drinker can do that. I was like, yeah, we've been working on it a good 7 years. So we had a good lawyer with her, but also the lawyer said, okay, go down to this treatment recovery place that's down at by Camp Bowling, do that. And also part of all the thing, you get a blow and go in your car. And oddly enough, one of the things you have to pay to do is spend one night in jail. And it's like, huh? So at the counseling place, I said, hey, go to Issaquah. That's the nicest jail around here. Go up there and pay your $100 and spend the night. And that's why we went up there.
Yep.
And she did everything in the treatment center said, and she went to AA meetings. And I got to say, one filled in the gaps from the other. It's like the treatment place had a whole lot of explanations and things, and the counselors themselves were recovering addicts or alcoholics. But AA meetings also filled in the gaps in between that. So it was pretty complete. And she was determined to be successful. And it really upset her to have people in there just kind of trying to figure out ways to circumvent the system. And that was the end of that.
But in all that.
$25,000 later.
Yeah. But in all that, from my observation, when she was busy drinking all those years, that was when she stopped doing supplements,
yep,
protein, all of that stuff, and her onset of the osteoporosis was real bad.
It kicked all that.
So
the alcoholism didn't kill her per se, but what it did to it really set the stage and really took a lot out of her body
physically. It really did. It really wrecked her.
And then to have a few years down the road, you know, 5 years later, to have a serious medical thing pop up where she had an infection in her back and they didn't know what it was. And so for six months in 2015, I give her antibiotics 3 times a day in a PICC line, and I'm changing it out and doing all this stuff for 6 months straight. And during one of those things, it killed her white cell count, and she got a bilateral fungal infection in both lungs, which has up to a 92% mortality rate, and somehow she survived it only because she was already in the hospital getting antibiotics for everything else except a fungal thing.
But that
caused so much damage to her lungs, and that twice a year she'd be in the hospital with horrible bad pneumonia and all those antibiotics over the next 5 years. It you could just see her withering away.
But it all started with, like, her body was fucked up from all the drinking
and the so no bad. Supplements and that in a way is kind of where the bypass part comes in, because she didn't keep up on the stuff. She wasn't even eating regular food, which would be no good for anybody.
She ate Skittles and
chips
crackers. And I would see McDonald's,
yeah,
like McDonald's burgers
after, like, surgery. Yeah,
dude. Oh, mom.
Well, that's right. If I can't get my fix one way, I'm going to get my fix in another way. And you're just looking for relief from the pain. And if one isn't doing it, then I need to find something else. That is easier than doing the work, as you guys know, because you lived it with her. You know, I think looking back now, you could say, oh, this and this really would have helped her overcome these issues. But we can't do that. We don't have the luxury of that. All we can do is say, here's what I noticed, here was what I witnessed, here's what I lived through. I wish I would have done X, Y, and Z, because maybe it would have prevented this, right? So, I mean, from your guys' perspective, it just seemed like this just kind of went in a progression. I'm not happy with the way that I look. This dark cloud is always hanging over me. I like to take care of everybody else before myself. I found this way to lose weight. And now that doesn't work after I've lost weight. So now I'm going to take this very serious step and have bariatric surgery, right? Yep. And then I have this surgery and I have some success, but I realize it doesn't fix what I am looking for. So now I'm turning to something else because I feel like a failure. Does exactly that seem right to be kind of, okay.
Right.
So, okay. So these might be really difficult questions and I don't know if you can answer them or not, but do you believe she would have become dependent on alcohol if she had not had RNY?
No.
No.
Because for one, it just simply would take too long for the alcohol to absorb. It was like an instant buzz, like what you see people on the streets with meth and crack and everything. That's that instant high and bam, that's what it was.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Let alone the predisposition to it in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think she was trying to escape from? Or what pain do you think she was trying to cover up? Maybe when she first underwent RNY and then when she turned to alcohol.
I think there was still pain from when she was a kid because her dad kind of would make fun of her because just wasn't aware. I mean, he apologized for it years later, but it still stuck with her, you know, like at the beach used to be able to ride horses and stuff. And she can recall overhearing him say, you better get that horse over there. She might hurt this other little one by getting on it. And they used to even draw comics, making fun of each other and stuff. Well, he drew a picture of her wearing his huge dress and on the corner, he put a tag. It said, Seattle Tent and Awning on it, that kind of stuff. And it stuck with her and it hurt her.
And oh, my God.
Although they totally made up for it stuff, it still bugged her because he didn't realize the impact it was having on her. But, like,
no.
I think what's a definite thing that happened with her is what I think happens with a lot of people that say get divorced. They think, oh, I just get a divorce and it's going to fix everything. No, it doesn't. You just trade one set of problems for another set of problems. And with her and the bypass, I think that was still a thing. And then all of a sudden the alcoholism came up and it was like, well, once she got cured of the drinking, we probably had 5 really good years in between before the medical stuff started. And it was like, so many missed opportunities, you know, looking back on it, like, dang. But it's all just a series of like things that takes to unravel, but have another medical thing after alcoholism and after not having taken your supplements for so many years of a bypass, it's like
yeah,
your body's already battered and beaten up. And just one yeah more thing is going to break the camel's back. And it did. It really did.
Yeah.
Well, it's so hard for, you know, as a parent, there's bound to be a time, a certain time during your child's life where you do something that just doesn't mash up, you know, that they'll carry with them. And the thing about that I really had to come to grips with as a father myself is you can apologize to them when they're old enough to understand for something that you did when they were too young to understand the impact, you know, the full impact, but it doesn't change the feeling that they've carried with them for all of those years. They still, I mean, they understand, they're old enough to understand the apology as an adult, but that apology will not heal that wound that they've carried with them for all of those years. And so, I mean, it's good that he got a chance to do that, but it's almost more at the end of the day, it almost, you know, it's kind of a cop out for the adult to apologize, you know, to the adult child, because it just makes you feel better. It lets you, you know, you let yourself off the hook by saying, well, I apologize for it now, so we're all good. But it just doesn't, that's not the kind of Band-Aid to heal that kind of wound.
Right. The only people who can heal those types of traumas are the victim. That's it. Right. There isn't a single thing anybody outside of you, of themselves, of yourself, can do to fix that.
Yeah.
And
logically, you can accept it and choose to move on from that, but that still doesn't fix always fix the emotional damage, scars. And
no,
there's not much you could really do about it.
So if somebody they've had bariatric surgery and they realize that they are perhaps transferring some addiction or they notice that a vice is taking control in their life, what do you guys wish that you maybe would have tried or done when you realized that she was turning to alcohol?
I think as a family, not I think we, if I have any role in any of it, it was, oh, not us. Like, no, that's not us. Like, it's not.
We don't have that kind of problem.
It's not that bad. Like, it surely is not that bad. No, it was pretty early on, pretty damn quickly. But I just, it's a number of things. Like, you know, I had a newborn daughter. You know, I had a very, very young kid. I was trying to support her and feed her. Like, everyone was busy, and in the scope of all of that stuff, like, we would have conversations about it regularly. Yeah. But it was always that thing of like, it'll get better.
Yeah.
It'll be fine, I'm sure.
It'll be okay.
It'll be fine. Also, I remember it being incredibly difficult to get her help the few times that we did try, because the state and all these facilities, it doesn't matter how much money you have, they were like, well, does she want to go? Of course she doesn't want to fucking go. Okay, yeah. Well then, sorry, there's nothing we can do for you. What?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Because towards God, end, she did want to go to some places, and there's very few choices, particularly if you're looking for a place that's like meant for women and stuff. And even a few years, a couple years even before that, she said, you try to send me to rehab, I'm going to divorce you, period.
Yeah.
Flat out.
Yeah.
But, and that's why I never just gave an ultimatum.
I don't think she ever would have.
No, I don't think so either.
But
I still had to live with her though.
Yeah. But I just remember being very difficult the few times that we really actually tried to plan something. Couldn't do it.
She was really protective over, oh no, it's my right. Everybody else drinks, I'm going to drink, was a kind of mantra for quite a while.
Yeah.
And then it was like, what do we do? We've not ever encountered anything like
I just wish that we would have said something and done something much, much sooner and recognized the scope of it, as opposed to going, nah, it'll be all right. Because that's what we did.
Particularly awareness going into it before having the bypass, be more aware of what goes on, the relationship changes, and especially like the statistics that they have now that that and the other can happen. That didn't exist back, and even in 2001, it was like, nothing.
Well, and that's part of the reason that Jason and I started East to West, right? Is that we realized there was this huge gap of support and just like knowledge about what the experience is like. And our whole goal at East to West is to help people find the lasting success that we have, and to partner with people like you who have lived through something really traumatic, really awful, to gain your insights so that we can learn, okay, what can we do as patients, or what can we do as people who love somebody who's been through bariatric surgery? What can we do to help them overcome these hurdles when they, you know, when they arrive? So I guess that's kind of like my last question is, you know, are there things that you wish you would have done, or is there something or some things that you want bariatric patients to know about your experience trying to help your wife and your mom overcome, you know, alcoholism after bariatric surgery?
Yeah, because a part of that too is she had real genuine regrets afterwards once she got sobered up, and that was another dark cloud, and a new dark cloud she carried around instead of that regret and that remorse. She'd be, oh, I'm so sorry. I just, you know, it was like, kind of comes to a point where you got to let it go. But I think, if anything, sharing our story, what happened to her, this was real life, it was recent, and these are the facts as they transpired, and here's the timeline. Boom. And if you think it can't be you're already in trouble.
Sharing the information with extended family as well, because a lot of the times when we would have, you know, at dinners, there was, you know, Thanksgiving or whatever, and you're taking her away, none of the family had any idea. Like, this was an immediate family thing, and we we could have reached out for help so many damn times, but like, we didn't.
They weren't there though, her parents especially, just like,
oh, I know, but like,
other way, mine would have, I think, been more receptive if it wasn't their daughter.
But we were always continually having to educate and bring everybody up to speed whenever something major would happen. And I guess anyone that is looking to have a surgery like that, really, really talk to your extended family as well. And, you know,
yeah, I think that's an excellent point. Involve the extended family. If you decide to have the surgery, tell them, here, these are some things that could go wrong, yeah, more than just the physical surgery. See, and we didn't know anything about that. I was focused on the surgery part. And the one thing that I was okay with it going on is that the doctor said, well, worse comes to worse, we can reverse it. Well, he could reverse it anyway. He yeah. had the skills to do that. It was like, okay, have you ever had to do that? One patient, he said, I had to do that because they just wouldn't keep up with the supplements and stuff. And they were yeah. like dying on the vine all right away. So I was like,
yeah.
All right. But
well, and I think
awareness.
You guys bring up a really excellent point. You know, a very small percentage of people. So 250,000 people have weight loss surgery every year. And they think that only 10 to 15% of those people actually make their procedure public to their immediate family.
Wow.
So most people go through this and never tell a soul outside of their doctor. And what you highlight is, while that might seem like a very terrifying thing to say to people, it could actually save your life in the long run. Because the more eyes, the more ears, the more people that you have invested in your health, the more resources that could be available to you, right? It's just, again, it's more eyes. It's just, so I understand why people don't want to share, because they're ashamed or they think that it's a personal failure. But if you find yourself in another vice after surgery and you haven't shared it, you're just now repeating that pattern. You're trying to keep things hidden and secret that are not going well. But we can't do it alone. We can't.
No.
It takes a village. Like we always say this, it takes people in your corner to help get you through. And I think it's very much true for extended family. And this isn't just bariatrics. This is people struggling with addiction, period. Families yeah. struggling with addiction, period. Yeah. To bring it out of the darkness and to shine light on it allows us to very clearly see what's going on, right? You're not going to work on a car. You're not going to rebuild a car in the dark. You're going to have 8,000 spotlights pointing at that thing every little direction so you can see every nut. You can see every crack. But if you don't shine that light in there, everyone's working in the dark.
Right.
It doesn't work that way.
And I'm going to guess as to what one of the primary reasons why a lot of people don't share that they've had surgery. Oh, you've taken the easy way out to get weight loss. How many times did y'all hear that?
Oh, man.
Bingo.
Yeah.
Oh, you did it the easy way. You just didn't not have that second piece of cake and go for a walk after dinner.
And all four of us know that is the most bullshit statement that has ever been spoken on the planet, because it is the hardest way out. You are committing to the most difficult road out of obesity and into health. The easy way would have been just continue to do what you were doing. That's the easy way.
Yeah.
So you want to come at me with that? Oh, I'm going to come at you with.
I'm not a violent person, but I'll hold them down if you want to hit them.
Perfect. We can tag team on that. Yeah. Well, gentlemen, is there anything that you felt left unsaid? I just want to kind of give you the last moment to say anything if you feel that something was not said.
I'm glad you invited us. And if you ever want to do it again or talk more about it in depth about something, I'm here. I'm here for you.
Thanks for having us.
Definitely. Wait for my check in the mail.
Yeah, by the way, you have to pay him. Sorry.
Oh, joke's on you.
Awkward.
Well, gentlemen, we know how difficult this conversation was, and we are just so very thankful for your openness and honesty when it comes to talking about the woman that you loved and still love today. Her story is going to resonate with anybody who has had or thinking about having bariatric surgery, and the fact that you are open to sharing her story means that we can be more prepared for what is ahead in our lives. So thank you very much for doing this.
Yeah, definitely. Very, very well.
Thanks for having us.
Very glad.
All right, Jason, my friend, you want to take us out?
Yes, sir. Gentlemen, just want to echo what April said. Thank you so much. This is very impactful. It's coming from somebody who's also lost his mother. I feel exactly where you guys are coming from. So the hole really never does go get filled after that. So I'm right there with you.
Yeah, thanks, man.
No worries. Just want to thank everybody for the support that you guys have given us. Do not forget to check our YouTube channel, and please like, share, subscribe, leave us reviews on there. We also need reviews on your favorite podcast player. You can leave reviews there as well. All of that just helps us continue to bring the message to more bariatric patients such as yourself and ourselves. So Just remember, at the end of the day, you've got this, we've got you, and we'll see you next time.
Awesome. Right. Thanks, guys.
See you.
Bye-bye.